Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Warning. This book contains several crime scene photos that are graphic in nature and may be very disturbing to some people. Do not proceed under the age of 18 or are disturbed by scenes of death and violence. One after another, young women disappeared without a trace in the night. One by one, their brutalized bodies turned up. The macabre crime scene suggested they shared the same cruel fate. Abducted, bound, and raped, all fell prey to an unknown killer. All became the victims of a deadly deception. The book that we're featuring this evening is Deadly Deception, True Story of Tampa Serial Killer Bobby Joe Long, special guest journalist and author J.T. Hunter. J.T. Hunter is not connected as of yet. We contacted or spoke this morning, so I'm sure he is just a moment late connecting to the program. I'll just set the stage here that we are going to be talking about May 13th, 1984, Mother's Day, in a Hillsborough County Sheriff Department, and a Lieutenant Gary Terry, 13 years on the force. Here we go. Welcome to the program, journalist and author J.T. Hunter.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Yes, I just introduced that we set the stage in Hillsborough County and the Sheriff Department and Lieutenant Gary Terry. So tell us what call he gets and what he sets off on this incredible journey here with Bobby Joe Long. So tell us about this first phone call and what it contains and what he is told on the phone that day, May 13th.
Okay, well, yeah, he got a call that the body of a young Oriental female had been found by a couple of teenage boys in a remote area in a Tampa suburb there in Hillsborough County. And he responded out there, you know, and of course it being the timing of it being on Mother's Day, you know, kind of got a reaction from him initially. Sure. To have to respond to such a thing on a day like that. He responded out there to the scene and you know, found the victim out there.
Now you talk about what this woman is found in this at this crime scene here, and you describe and you include the, as we did in the warning, you include these crime scene photos. So tell us what the nature of the what they find at the crime scene in terms of her condition, and as you describe, please tell us what they find in that. As you say, it's burned into Lieutenant Terry's memory. So tell us what he sees and witnesses.
Well, the victim was bound. Her hands were bound behind her back, and she was face down. She was nude, fully nude, and what had really left a really lasting impression on Terry was the way that her body had been positioned. Her legs had been purposely spread wide, you know, in order to shock whoever found the body.
essentially. And it certainly did shock Terry and the rest of the officers that were there at the scene. Terry had said, you know, made a comment that he'd never seen a body displayed in that way before, at a scene before,
right.
And it really, really frightened him to think, you know, who would have done this and, you know, been so evil, essentially, to pose a body like this, you know, let alone murdering this victim, but then to leave her body in the state, you know, on top of it. And, you know, and it was pretty gruesome too, because the body had been there for a while. So there was maggots crawling around on her and flies and all that, you know, on top of it. So, it was a gruesome discovery. And, you know, as you said, as you mentioned, there are some crime scene photos of the victim as well as the other victims in the book as well. And they are, you know, some of them are pretty, pretty graphic, pretty disturbing.
Now, you talk about the newspaper coverage May 15th. Investigators are lacking for clues in girl's death, but they do have the description, 5'2" and 88 pounds, long black hair. Then, but you say through fingerprints, a couple days later, they have her as identified as, and again, Lana Long, 20-year-old dancer at the Sly Fox Strip Club. So anyway, she is originally from Los Angeles, and she's just recently in Florida. You talk about what the ME concludes. What did he find out from the medical examiner? What's his conclusion? And then before we talk about just a couple weeks later and the next corpse found.
Well, as you said, yeah, they did determine through fingerprint analysis that it was Lana Long, and she had last been seen alive leaving her apartment complex near the University of South Florida May 11th, so a few days earlier. And the medical examiner concluded she'd been killed by strangulation. It was pretty evident upon examination of the body that she'd been strangled to death.
Now, while police are still gathering evidence, obviously not too many leads, and obviously don't have any concrete suspects whatsoever, it's May 27th, 1984, as you write. 2 weeks later, another nude corpse turns up in Tampa Bay area, and again, Lieutenant Terry arrives at the scene. So what's different about this crime scene and this murder in particular?
Well, there's a difference. There's similarities and differences. And the similarity is this one, like the prior victim, this victim's hands have both been tied behind her back by a similar type of clothesline rope, as it was described. And but in addition, there was stab wounds on the second victim to her neck, so severely that her neck had her head had almost been decapitated. The slash was so deep on her, and she also had blunt trauma injuries to her head as well. So a little more violent ending for the second victim.
Right. Now, you say 3 weeks later there's passed without any new bodies, and they're still working this investigation. Obviously, you talk about June 24th, and a man named Ronnie Barnes, he's working at an orange grove in Pleasant Grove. Tell us what he discovers and about our next victim.
Yeah, so this third victim, this Ronnie Barnes was working in orange grove out there, another rural area around the Tampa area there. And as he was mowing in and out of the trees there, he noticed a strong odor. Kind of a rotten meat kind of smell. And it got worse the closer he approached a tree. So he got off the mower he had there to go take a look at it. And he found another body. This one was a pretty badly decomposed one, virtually almost mummified. And, you know, he obviously notified authorities as soon as he found that.
You talk about the decomp so advanced that she weighed an actual only 25 pounds.
Yeah, so she had been, definitely been out there for a while. Estimated time of death a week to 2 weeks earlier. So she'd been there a while, and you know, exposure to the Florida sun in the summertime, it certainly could take its toll.
Now, what they find out about Elizabeth Loudenback is that she's a factory worker, 22 years old, lived with her parents in North Tampa, was last seen June 8th, but she's not a prostitute or dancer. And you also say there's no ligatures found, but there are. Tell us what other things in common with the other two crimes, and are the other two crimes quickly linked, and what do they, and can they link, and how do they link this third murder with those two?
Yeah, so there, the investigators and crime scene technicians were able to recover some red fibers at the scene for this third victim, and subsequently these were matched, and it was determined that these red fibers had to come from the same source, come from the same place as fibers that were found at the Lenalong crime scene, the first victim, and then the second victim as well, who was Michelle Sims. So they had the commonality of these red fibers at all three of these crime scenes. So it was obvious, you know, at this point to Gary Terry and his group there, his group of investigators, that, you know, these three were certainly linked. You know, they had a serial killing on their hands.
They talk about before they can really do anything, and we'll talk about soon, they contact the FBI, but before that even happens, you say near in another county, Pasco County line, you talk about another person is found, an 18-year-old named Chanel Williams. Tell us about how they find her and what, if any, similarities and, like you said, differences regarding this murder.
Well, like the other three, this fourth one was, the body was in, you know, in a remote area, actually at the entrance of a cattle ranch, and there were similar things at the crime scene. You know, the primary one being these red fibers turning up again. You know, there was a difference in this victim, that this victim actually had a gunshot wound to her neck and head, unlike the prior three victims. So a little bit of difference in the murders, the cause of death in the four victims, but a lot of other things in common, including, you know, the binding of the hands and the red fibers and these sorts of things. So certainly things linking them all together.
You say soon after, in September, Lieutenant Terry requests a criminal personality profile from the FBI, and Special Agent Stanley Jacobson prepares a profile. So tell us what they looked at, and what they concluded, at least for this preliminary profile, to help and assist police to find the serial killer.
Yeah, the FBI profiling folks there, you mentioned Special Agent Jacobson, he was kind of took the lead on it. But so he and his group, they looked at, you know, the crime scene photos, obviously, to see the common ways the bodies had been left and things that were found there. And they reviewed those and forensic evidence found at the scenes. They also interviewed Gary Terry and the other homicide detectives involved in the investigations. And they took all that information and then, of course, integrated it with their experience in other cases with other killers to come up with their profile of the, you know, the likely killer. And so, you know, they generated the psychological profile in the hopes of aiding Terry and his men in trying to figure out who was doing these killings.
Now, again, they don't have much time to wait, and you talk about October 14th, 2 weeks after Chanel Williams' discovery, another woman, Karen Dinsfriend, 28 years old, another Orange Grove on the east side of, almost in the same area. She was last seen October 14th, working at the area of Nebraska in Hillsborough. again, tell us what they found there that was common, and what is the reaction from police and you, as you write about, what is the reaction in the community in terms of panic?
Well, like the prior, like these prior victims, Karen's body had clear evidence of having been bound. Her hands and feet had visible ligature marks, as well as her neck. So she had been bound very similarly to the prior victims. And these red fibers, again, this is the big closest thing they have, I guess, to a smoking gun at this point, is these red fibers, this common element, this common thread matching the all the prior killings as well. And so sure enough, you know, the subsequent analysis by the FBI labs confirms that these red fibers are all coming from the same place. They're all originating the same source. So, of course, if they can ever figure out what the source is, this will go a long way to you know, conclusively linking all these murders. And, you know, as you can imagine, finding these kind of bodies pretty close in time together, these similar circumstances of the killings certainly raised alarm in the Tampa area around there. A lot of people started getting really nervous and worried. You know, obvious that there's somebody out there that's up to evil things, and nobody really had any clue at this point who it could be. So anybody was a potential killer. So a lot of people were looking over their shoulders and being careful and hoping that they weren't the next victim.
And yet, it's not too long after. You talk about Halloween Eve, October 30th, 1984, 200 feet from the Pasco Hillsboro County line. She's ID'd many weeks later, but this is Kimberly Hopps, 22-year-old, last seen October 4th. And police are frustrated. And now, you could say there's good reason for people to be afraid, because even though this is in the 80s, this is an era that's already passed where we've had some infamous people, and you introduce somebody. There's an incredible story where somebody offers their services. So tell us about what police are. You say they're frustrated, but then somebody offers their services. Tell us who that would be.
Well, yeah, familiar, very familiar name. As you mentioned, they're probably going to be the most infamous serial killer in our country. Ted Bundy had offered his services. He had heard about the killings and went so far as to send a letter over to the sheriff there in Hillsborough County, offering to help out in the case and making some suggestions, including, you know, to watch the areas where the bodies had been found to see if the killer came back, to relive the experience, or, you know, even more ghastly, maybe to try to do something with the bodies there as well, as Bundy himself was known to have done. So he offered that suggestion. Probably with not much else to go on, I'm sure the investigators were tempted to try to go down that path, but they didn't end up ever finalizing any sort of arrangement to enlist Bundy's help. But certainly an interesting possibility there.
You do say that what they do, though, is maybe it's not from Bundy's suggestion, but they say because there's so many victims have been seen around the Nebraska Avenue, which is a red light district, or part of it anyway, he assigned a special unit to conduct night surveillance in what you call the killer's hunting ground, and yet still no solid leads.
Yeah, nothing to that point. They were still basically chasing a phantom at that point.
Now, again, not too much longer after this, that you have November 4th, and someone's, a teenage girl, is abducted on her way home from work. Tell us about what happens here, because this person gets to tell the tale.
Yeah, this turned out to be a big break in the case, and it was early November, November 2nd, this teenage girl, a 17-year-old girl. Her name was Lisa McVeigh. She had finished up working her night shift or late shift at the donut place there in Tampa. And she was on her way home. She rode her bike to work and, you know, rode her bike back home at night. And she was pedaling her bike back home from work and ended up having someone jump out from behind a parked van and knocking her off her bike and grabbing her and taking her, dragging her across the street and putting her in another parked vehicle and abducting her. And this man had a gun and warned her when he grabbed her not to scream or he would blow her brains out. And she believed him, and he ordered her to keep her eyes closed so she couldn't see who he was. So she never saw his face, but he did force her into his car, and she was very much afraid that she was going to be killed. So she decided what she would do is just go along with whatever he said and try to, you know, try not to make him mad or anger him. And so when he ordered her to strip, she did it. And he ordered her to do sexual things for him, she complied. And so after getting her in the car and doing these things, he drove off with her in the car. And ended up taking her back to his residence eventually. Took her in there and all the while kept her either made sure her eyes were closed or blindfolded her at various times as well. And, you know, they parked the car and got out. And he told her that they were at an office building and they were going to get out and go inside of it. He let her out of the car through the parking lot up through an entranceway and up some stairs and into a room and ended up keeping her there. And she described the ordeal as a very kind of strange ordeal because this abductor went from kind of back and forth on his attitude and his mood and the way he treated her. You know, at times he was very gruff with her and very rough. And then, you know, suddenly he could change his demeanor and be very kind and, you know, be very caring almost towards her.
Yeah, what you read is fascinating because it really gets inside likely the behavior he had with every one of these women, except for this reason. And you do say one of the reasons why he says later, she really does have this, she really decides to have a strategy to cooperate so that she can survive. So she's talking to him. She even talks about her own family, her own father in the conversation at some point. But you talk about how he has, after he's sodomized her, basically taken her into the shower and gently washing her and then blow drying her hair and telling her she has pretty hair and removing the blindfold for a little while. So, yeah, it's an incredible 180-degree difference from where he starts and where he thinks he's somehow had a relationship with this woman. So she really does psychologically play into whatever she thinks he might really want and really for her own survival. She's very, very clever in this regard, isn't she?
Yeah, that's exactly as you say. That's really what was pointed to later as to why she survived this encounter, whereas the prior women had not been able to. You know, she really did keep her head about her during all of this.
Yeah.
And was able to survive it.
Yeah, there's a couple of times he tests her because he goes to an ATM, he goes to a garage, and then meanwhile she uses these opportunities to look around and remember details that will help, she believes, law enforcement later to be able to apprehend this person, and it does help in aiding all the things she does get a peek at under this blindfold.
Yeah, she was able to get little glimpses out of the blindfold while she was in the car. So she's able to see, you know, for example, he actually told her he had to stop and, you know, get some money. So she was able to kind of peek out and look around and see some landmarks, you know, including some signs for some businesses, some hotels along the road and near the interstate and whatnot. And yeah, so later on, after she was safe again, she was able to lead investigators to these areas, to these landmarks.
And it's interesting too, because I don't know how you capture the horror that this woman is enduring for the couple of days, because he's saying things, well, I don't really want to let you go, I just might keep you, and then hug and kisses her forehead. So there's a lot of things where she's not out of the woods till she's out of the woods, and he leaves her somewhere, and she then, what does she do?
Yeah, she keeps, you know, placating him as best she can and going along with it and really trying to make this connection with him, which she seems to have done, you know, since she did was able to survive the encounter and you know, he did become more gentle with her and everything. And, you know, she even told them that her father was very sick and these sorts of things to try to garner sympathy with him. And so eventually he decided he was going to release her. You know, he said, you know, I'd like to keep you basically, but I can't, you know, and these sorts of things. And finally ended up driving her away and leaving her on a corner in Tampa, in the downtown Tampa area, and left her there. So she was able to then make her way back home afterwards.
Now, we talked about the things that she could see, but she was really hindered by that blindfold. But a couple really important things that help police, and you talk about the car and the insignia that's on that car that she remembered. Tell us what those two things that she did remember, and it does lead police to look for that vehicle. So tell us what she does remember and see and recount to police.
Yeah, so in addition to seeing these hotel signs and various other landmarks outside, she was able to see inside the car at times as well. And she saw the color, and she was able to describe that it was this, you know, dark red or maroon colored vehicle, and it had a white interior. And she also saw that this wording, this strip on the dashboard that said Magnum in silver letters. So she was able to tell the investigators about that, and that ended up proving to be a key point, as you indicated later on. And, you know, she even was able to describe a little bit of the physical appearance of her abductor. She saw a little bit of him. She saw, you know, his nose and ears and his general build, you know, from both touching him and then also kind of what little peek she could get as well. So she's able to describe him a little bit too. But certainly the interior of the vehicle was very important.
Now, you talk about just now they have a description of the man in his car, and of course they're, you know, they have some dedicated officers that are going to take that information and do something with it in terms of looking out for that, as you say, a detailed search for that vehicle, and then a strategy as a result for the police. But November 6th, you talk about a couple young girls horseback riding in Zephyr Hills, and again a strange odor coming, and so they find another body. So tell us about what they find and what do detectives do next.
Yeah, so on November 6th, you know, there was a
a couple women were out riding, going for a ride on their horses in Zephyr Hills in the late morning, and they noticed, there was a smell they noticed, and they kind of followed that, and it led them to another body, that very, very decomposed body, pretty skeletonized. And, they obviously alerted authorities to that. And, sure enough, it turns out that this is another victim of this same killer, still unidentified killer. Yet another victim here, on November 6th. And they weren't able to identify that victim until quite a bit later, through dental records, I think is what it ended up being. And she had been dead for quite some time, several weeks, which explained the state of her body. And while they were still trying to figure out who that was, another victim turned up.
In the midst of this, too, there was a task force set up. So tell us a little bit just about that task force being formed.
Well, because the bodies were being discovered in different jurisdictions around the area there, it was decided to form this task force with all of the affected agencies involved. And the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office was going to take the lead, since most of the bodies have been from there, but there are also ones found in the Tampa Police Department's jurisdiction as well. So they were included as part of this task force as well, and Pasco County too. So it was a multi-jurisdictional task force with Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office taking the lead, specifically with Gary Terry kind of overseeing the whole thing.
Right. Now you talk about November 14th, November 15th, and again the maroon car, two-door, passed a couple officers, Detective Helms and Tampa PD. So tell us what happens when they pull over and what do they find?
Yeah, so these two detectives were driving around the strip area, kind of the red light area, as you said earlier, on Nebraska Avenue, keeping their eyes open. And they, sure enough, they encountered a maroon two-door car, passed by them, going the opposite direction. And it seemed to match the description that Lisa McVeigh had given about her abductor's vehicle. So they promptly turned around and followed it and initiated a traffic stop, pulled it over. And there was, one person was in the car driving it, and a male who they were able to identify when he handed over his driver's license as Robert Joe Long. And, they kind of made up the story about why they had pulled him over, that there was some hit-and-run accident nearby that they were investigating, and his vehicle kind of matched something that was involved in that. It was kind of the story they gave him. So they were able to interact with him a little bit, ask him some questions, and take a look at his vehicle up close a little bit there. And, we're able to actually take some photographs of him and the car as well. He wouldn't let them search the car, but he did agree to let them take pictures of the car and hit himself as well. And, following that, they ended up letting him go his own way there after that. But this was another break in the case because of the close resemblance to what Lisa McVeigh had described.
Absolutely. But as you say, the ruse they use is to say they're stopping him for something, to take some photos of his car. They do notice the Magnum insignia and all the description that, like you say, that Lisa has given them. And then they say, hey, okay, you're free to go. Thanks. And he says, listen, anytime. We need this JT to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor of the program this evening, ZipRecruiter. A fresh new year has begun, and if you're setting new goals for your business, it's extremely difficult to reach them without the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you go about finding them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. They even review every application to identify the top candidates so you never miss a great match. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidate finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time to try it for free, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Now we have Bobby Joe Long not understanding that police really have a really good lead and evidence sufficient to be able to arrest him. But what do police do, and what does Bobby Joe Long do?
Well, soon after the stop, he actually called the police department and kind of complained about the being pulled over and, you know,
sure.
Said he wanted to be notified when the car was found, these sorts of things. So he was certainly a little bit concerned after being pulled over there that they might be onto him a little bit. And the police, meanwhile, they had been subpoenaing bank records around the North Tampa area, trying to find something that would correlate to when Lisa McVeigh had said that her abductor had stopped at an ATM. And they were able to find bank records that did seem to match that time, 3:49 in the morning. Those records actually were connected to Bobby Joe Long's bank account. And detectives also were able to show a photo pack of suspects to Lisa McVeigh, including the picture of Long from his traffic stop that they had taken when they pulled him over. They included that in the photo pack, and she identified Long out of that as well. So using all that evidence, the circumstantial evidence, they were able to get a warrant with both an arrest warrant and also a search warrant for Long's vehicle, the Magnum, as well as his residence too. So they had surveillance going on Long, and the police followed him to a movie theater there in Tampa, and went in to see a movie there, and they had detectives stationed in the parking lot and outside the theater there, and also in the actual theater as well with the movie he was seeing at the time. And they followed him out of there and arrested him after he came out of the theater. They arrested him in the parking lot.
Yeah, very interesting too. What we hadn't mentioned too is that part of the forensic evidence that police did find at the crime scene was at least tire prints. And they identified him as a Goodyear Viva tire and a Vogue tire, usually from a Cadillac, you would say. But anyway, they impounded the car, and so they got confirmation of what they had suspected as well in that regard, didn't they?
Yes, yeah, that was another key part of the evidence that they were able to accumulate there was the tires. And like you mentioned, this was an unusual tire. This one type, and it was a type that you could turn the tire up so the white walls were facing either in or out, and sure enough, these tires ended up matching the ones that were on Bobby Joe Long's vehicle.
Now you talk about how police proceed with this Bobby Joe Long. What's their strategy in terms of always trying to get them to not lawyer up, ask for an attorney, and actually give them some information? Makes things a lot easier. And so they go in with some sort of strategy to try to be able to elicit some sort of a confession. How do they approach Bobby Joe Long, and what are the results? What did they get from him?
Well, yeah, they put him in a interview room and, you know, kind of did the small talk initially and whatnot. And he was cooperative in discussing the Lisa McVay's abduction, how he had gone about doing that, and, you know, kind of why he had decided to take her and, you know, what he did afterwards and these sorts of things. And he was perfectly willing to talk about that. And from there, you know, they were hoping to get him to segue into these murders, but he didn't just kind of go into it. They started asking him kind of general questions about, you know, physical evidence, if he knows what that is, and, you know, things like hair and blood and fingerprints. And they got even more specific to mentioning fibers and tire impressions. And when they started mentioning those things, you know, they noticed that Long's face, his expression changed there a little bit. He seemed to be a little worried maybe. And he started showing pictures then of some of the victims and things, and asking him if he had seen any of the victims before. And, you know, he denied it, said he'd never seen them, never picked up these people or seen them before. They went one by one through all the victims, and he denied all of them. You know, after they got through that, they took a break for a while. Long went to the bathroom, and when he came back, they picked up right back where they were, and they actually told him, well, look, you know, we've brought in a couple of these experts from Washington, D.C. to help take a look at the evidence we have and things. And, you know, we know your car has these particular tires on it, and it's the same tire tracks that were left at several of the crime scenes. And you know, the more they mentioned these things, you know, kind of the more concerned he seemed to look. And he said, well, it sure seems like the complexion of this case has changed since we took this break. And he said, I think I might need an attorney. And the detectives interviewing him kind of looked at each other for a moment, but they kept going. And, you know, they said, well, hey, nothing's really changed. You know, we know you did these things. We just want to know why you did it and kind of how you went about doing it, these sorts of things. We have all the evidence already that we need, you know, to connect you to these crimes. We just, you know, want to hear your side of it. And so after confronting him with all this evidence that they had amassed, that they had gathered together, you know, Bobby, he sat there for a little bit kind of quietly, and then, you know, leaned back in his chair, took a breath, and kind of grinned at him and said, all right, I guess you got me good. And said, yeah, I killed them. And they asked him, well, how many of them? And he said, all of them, all the ones in the paper. And so so after that, he went ahead and went through one by one the victims, detailing how he had come across them and how he had gotten them in his car and, you know, what he had done to them afterwards. And gave him a lot of details about how he went about killing all these different women.
You also talk about, like, he discussed all the ruses he used to be able to lure these people, and there were slight variations, but then he would get to having a knife. There was things he would ask if they wanted a ride. But you also talk about what his motivation was. They wanted to know how he picked his victims. And so what does he say about how he picked his victims, and also some of the ruses and some of the things that he disclosed to them that else actually later would put things together for them a bit better than they understood?
Well, yeah, he mentioned for some of the victims why he picked them. It was just based on their appearance, you know, how they looked. They were kind of dressed, you know, in kind of revealing clothes, or looked kind of sleazy or whatnot. And that was the reason why he had decided on some of them, he mentioned. And, you know, once the way he went about it was, you know, offering them a ride. And, you know, a lot of the victims were either prostitutes or dancers in these adult establishments, these nude bars in the Tampa area. And so a lot of it involved pretending like he was soliciting them and kind of going along with that to get him in the car. But not all of them were that way. So some of the ones that weren't, he had other ways of getting them to lower their guard. Just offering to, help them out if it looked like that they were, shouldn't be driving, for example. Maybe they were drunk or something, and so he needed to help them out and these sorts of things. So he definitely had these different ways of deceiving them to get them to lower their guard and get them into a position where he could, exert some control over them.
He also talked about other crimes, specifically rapes he had done in what he said were Miami and Fort Lauderdale. And tell us how he came upon those victims. What was his MO there?
Yeah, so the other really interesting aspect of this whole case is, besides the serial killings that Bobby Joe did, he also, well before that, he had a really long history, it turned out, of being a serial rapist. And he was known as the classified ad rapist, because what he would do is he would scour the classifieds looking for things for sale. A lot of times it would be things like, furniture, household furniture, or appliances, those sorts of things. And he would, call the number in the listing there, and from the conversation he would have on the phone, he would be able to tell whether or not it was a, potentially a good victim for him, someone that he could be with there alone and rape them and do what he wanted with them. So he was able to kind of figure that out based on the conversations he had with these people answering the phone, these women that he spoke to. And from there, he would set up a time to come by, pretending again that he was just there to look at this furniture or look at this house for sale. Sometimes it was, a for sale sign in the yard or something he saw. And he would knock on the door and, ask to see the house. And he did it during the time of day when, if there was a husband or a boyfriend or whatnot, that they would be more than likely at work. And, once he kind of figured out that was indeed the situation, he would overpower the women and rape them. And, he described these rapes later, some of them in real detail, the extent of the things he did with these women. And sometimes, it was younger girls too, young teenagers he was doing these things to. And he had a really long history of doing this. So left a lot of victims in his wake, not just the murder victims, but the rape victims as well.
Absolutely. He talks about later about estimating that he's damaged, destroyed about 100 people. Now you talk about that he also, after this interview, where he says he's done this maybe 15 rapes, after this interview, he says he would like to bring authorities to the remains of the other victims that they had not discussed. But you say overnight, something changed. Who did he see, and now what's his attitude towards helping authorities?
Yeah, he had mentioned that there were these undiscovered ones that he would lead him to. But the, Gary Terry, who's in charge of this again, these investigators had been working really long hours on this case for a real long time, putting in overtime, so much overtime over and over again. And now that they had their guy finally, it was just kind of a normal reaction, I guess, to relax a little bit. They were so worn down, he figured, well, we can continue this in the morning after we get a little bit of rest, a little bit of sleep, but overnight the public defenders there in Hillsborough County learned of that he had been, taken into custody, and they came and visited him and talked to him. So when when Terry and his folks tried to start back up again where they left off, Bobby refused to talk to them, you know, based on his discussions with the public defenders.
So they end up with how many confirmed bodies through confession and forensics and, well, bodies? How many are they looking at before we talk about, of course, the ensuing motions and delays and appeals? And so before we talk about that, how many do they have him dead to rights on?
Well, they have him linked to eight deaths, eight murders, you know, plus the abduction and the rape of Lisa McVeigh,
right.
You know, the 17-year-old that got away.
Now, how do police proceed? I mean, obviously they think, obviously he's hinted and intimated that there are other victims. You talk about getting a psychological evaluation as part of the court process as well. Again, you talk about, and with this book, your research, his past. So tell us about the psychological evaluation, and then before you talk about what they find out in terms of his past.
Yeah, so, you know, various medical experts had these evaluations of him and came to different opinions about what was wrong with him and why he had done the things he did. And, you know, and of course all this is slanted one way or the other. You know, the ones that are linked to the prosecution, of course, are trying to get these opinions that Bobby Joe, you know, although he may have had some brain trauma and whatnot in his past, that he still, at the time he committed these things, he knew what he was doing was wrong. And, you know, the experts linked to the defense, of course, wanted to be able to have these opinions that what his condition prevented him from knowing that he was doing the wrong thing. He couldn't help himself and these sorts of things. So there were different opinions that were offered from different psychologists. You know, one opined that Bobby Joe suffered from sexual sadism that caused his criminal behavior and his brain disorder. And that he had this medical condition that kind of caused him to enter this kind of altered state of consciousness when he committed these crimes. And, you know, another psychologist concluded that he had bipolar psychosis and an organic personality syndrome due to brain damage, because they found out that Bobby Joe had a pretty extensive history of different injuries to his head as he was growing up in his background, including when he was, you know, a young boy, and as he got older, he had a lot of these and different reasons, and including a major one when he was older, and shortly after he was married, actually, in 1974. He had a motorcycle accident, a really bad motorcycle accident. his car basically, or sorry, his motorcycle, he collided with a car when he was going about 65 miles an hour, and the collision sent him flying over the car and caused a lot of damage to his leg, but also to his head. And he was unconscious, knocked unconscious, and remained in the hospital for several months after that. And you know, the people that were close to him, including his wife, testified about how after this motorcycle accident, he really seemed to change after that. There was a lot of noted behavioral changes to him following that. So there was quite a bit of things in his background there from a physical, psychological standpoint to be considered when looking at these crimes he committed. And, you know, and on top of that, they had also, apart from the kind of the physical trauma, the brain trauma, the head trauma, those things, apart from that, they also had psychological issues based on his upbringing and his relationship with his mother. You know, it seems like these serial killers seem to have these kind of strange relationships with their mothers sometimes and have mommy issues going on. And it seems certainly seems to be the case with Bobby Joe as well, based on the history there.
You talked about another physical thing that created humiliation for him and shame was that he developed enlarged breasts during puberty. He produced abnormal amounts of estrogen, so he had breasts when he was a young boy, and to the point where they removed 6 pounds of excess tissue from his chest area. And you also talked about his relationship with his mother, but also just his attitude, talking about his mother in terms of being a bitch or a slut. So he had some, again, it seemed to be carry on into his attitude towards women in general, at least as we'll see as this story develops. At the same time, it started with at least some his view on about his mother and boyfriend. So tell us a little bit about what he had said later about the relationship and his mother's behavior as well.
Yeah, so his father had was absent from his life largely, and so it was him and his mother. And his mother worked in the name of it escapes me at the moment, but his mother had worked at kind of a bar, kind of a not a topless bar, but kind of a bar where the waitresses and bartenders are a little more friendly, I guess, with the customers and things. And so she worked at one of these kind of places, and would end up bringing different men home, all the time. And Bobby came to resent this quite a bit. He felt like his relationship with his mom was being displaced by all these various men that she was bringing home. And, he really grew to resent her and the way that she dressed and the way she flirted with these strangers all the time and brought them home. And, it really affected him, and he came to resent her quite a bit. And this was something that was pointed to later on at the trial, that he had, projected these feelings for his mother. He had then projected them onto the women that he was killing. His resentment and things onto them.
What we do find too is that that he has some normalcy in his life in terms of, at least outwardly, he gets married, and in January 1974 he gets married, but he also enlists in the Army in 1972. What's his Army record like? What does that consist of?
His Army record, from what I recall, he enlisted in the Army. He was ultimately not honorably discharged. He was dishonorably discharged for not fulfilling his duties as he was supposed to. And what coincided with that was this motorcycle accident, which really changed his personality quite a bit. As described by his wife and some other folks. So he didn't have an exemplary enlistment. He was dishonorably discharged ultimately.
He has a relationships too. You talk about the he's working as an X-ray technician, so there is. Of this full investigation, they do speak to people that were around before this killing spree begins to get a picture of this guy's behavior and how he could have developed into the serial killer that he became. They do talk to some people just for that anecdotal story about what he was like and what he exhibited in terms of his behavior.
Yeah, they did. They talked to a lot of people that he had worked with before, and as it turned out, he had worked as an X-ray technician at different hospitals around South Florida, including in Tampa. And they talked to a lot of the people that he worked with at these hospitals, and seemed to be that some of the common threads to these interviews were that, for one thing, he seemed to resent female authority for sure. And then another one was that he talked a lot about sex or trying to get with different girls or women and the things he would like to do with them sexually and things of that nature. So those are some of the common threads they found. And he also did some inappropriate things with some of the patients at times as well. But, you know, other people he had worked with before and some supervisors had described him as being, seeming like a pretty decent kind of guy in some respects and being a good worker. So it wasn't all negative recollections from the people that had known him.
Right. Now, meanwhile, you take us back to January 18, 1985. Detective Baker gets a call from Sergeant Price, Tampa Police Department. They have been contacted by an inmate named Scheidler. So there's some letters. Anyway, tell us what Bobby Joe Long is up to according to this inmate and what their response is.
Yeah, so when Bobby was being held, he befriended another inmate in there, this Jay Scheidler that you mentioned, and had tried to come up with an escape plan, essentially, is what he was plotting. And he confided in Scheidler and tried to get him to get in on this and help him out with this plan he had. And what he was going to do was offer to lead detectives, including Gary Terry and, some of his main investigators that had been chiefly involved in the case, to lead them to some other victims and that hadn't been discovered yet. And, he knew that if he did that, they would be more than willing to go out there with him. And his plan was once he got out there, he would have had somebody on the outside, would have concealed a gun for him, a sawed-off shotgun under a bridge at a particular location. And, once he got out there with the detectives, he would be able to get a hold of that gun and overpower them and kill them and get away.
Right.
So he had concocted this whole escape plan. And then Scheidler ended up alerting a private investigator. He knew about it, and that investigator then contacted the police about it.
Yeah, and then so they discover what his plan is. Now you take us to, as you say, Bobby Joe Long's first trial. This is April 1985 only in Dade County, and this is for the killing of. Tell us who this is for the killing of, and you have the fiber experts Michael Malone, and prosecutor is Phil Van Allen. So tell us. What this murder trial is for.
All right, so the first trial was held there in Dade City, you said. This was for Virginia Johnson.
Right.
She was actually one of the later victims found, one of the last ones that was found. But her trial ended up being the first one to go there in Dade City. And it didn't take long for the verdict to come in. Once the trial had started, it was just a week before the jury came to their verdict, and the deliberations weren't long either. Not even an hour to find him guilty of Johnson's murder.
And Florida's a death penalty state. So what was that? Was it a death penalty case?
Yes. So he was found guilty of first degree murder, unanimously, first degree murder. And so subsequent to that, the judge, follows all the jury's recommendation and sentenced Long to death. So that was his his first death sentence was for the murder of Johnson.
And then he proceeds to, not long after, July 25th, 1986, he gets a death sentence in the Michelle Sims case, right?
Yeah, in July of 86 is when he gets the death penalty in the Michelle Sims case. And in the meantime, there was a deal that was brokered and agreed to for the other cases that he was involved in. So what ultimately ended up happening was that he pled guilty to 8 of the killings, and then also to the abduction and rape of Lisa McVeigh, pursuant to this plea agreement. And the reason why he wanted to do the plea agreement was to avoid the death penalty as much as possible. He didn't want to get a death penalty in all these cases. The more death penalties you get, the harder it is to get them all reversed, among other things. So he entered in this agreement to get life sentences instead on these killings. So he got ended up being 26 life sentences is what it ended up amounting to, pursuant to the agreement, for all these other murders.
You talk about the same time that the CBS television, they have a report on serial killers, and they interview him, and he recounts many of the murders he committed. Tell us what he says, the gist of what he says in terms of trying to rationalize or comprehend what he did, the crimes he did.
Well, so one of the interesting things he mentioned in that interview was the way he described it. He didn't describe it as something he planned typically. It was more a spontaneous thing that just kind of occurred. He described it as like this urge that just kind of built up until he couldn't resist it anymore. So he might just be going out to do something else, to go to the grocery store or to go play racquetball. He liked to play racquetball. Something like that. And he might come across some girl and, he would get this urge and he wouldn't be able to resist it. So that's the way he described it to the CBS interviewer. And, he went on to talk about the way he went about these rapes and killings and always kind of followed the same sort of pattern. He said he'd see him walking down the street and then it would be like ABCD. He would pull him over. They'd get in. He'd drive away and then stop somewhere, pull out the knife or his gun, whatever he happened to have at the time, and tie him up, so he could have complete control over him. And then he would assault him and kill him after that. And kind of it always followed the same sort of pattern over and over again, including this deception to get him in the car initially and then going from there.
He also talked about in that interview two people had families that gave a damn about them, but the rest of them were just, he said, sluts out on the street. And he said that he picked, he said some of these people wouldn't be missed. And then he talked about Lisa McVeigh being an anomaly from his normal victim profile. Tell us about that and why that likely was quite true and really did aid in her survival.
Yeah, well, unlike a lot of his victims, Lisa wasn't a prostitute. She wasn't someone working at these nude bars or these clubs. She wasn't someone involved in that whole Nebraska Avenue street scene. So to Bobby Joe, she was in a different category. He didn't associate her with these kind of sluts or whatnot and people that wouldn't be missed. She was different, so that, I'm sure that helped her in of itself and enabled her to kind of take on this almost this girlfriend kind of role that she took on with him during the abduction, which, you know, allowed her to ultimately to survive it. So he certainly brought that up and you know, mentioned that as a reason why he decided to let her go, is that she wasn't like the other one. She was different.
Yeah. Now she gets to eventually, you talk about the trials and then many of the motions and reasons for appeal. Maybe you can briefly summarize some of that until we get to November 2nd, 1988, where Lisa McVeigh testifies. And we get the entire story. The jury gets the entire story, and the world gets the entire story at that testimony. But what are some of the basic issues that keep cropping up we get to the point where there's trials for the Virginia Johnson case, in the Virginia Johnson case?
Yeah, so one of the big issues for these appeals was the interview when Long confessed to the killings of all these women, and the fact that before he did that, he had mentioned that, you know, I think I need an attorney, or maybe I should have an attorney. And the fact that, you know, the interrogators at that point didn't just immediately stop questioning. They kept pressing forward with it. And so that was a big issue, you know, this violation of his rights in that respect. And so he's able to get a lot of traction with the courts with that as an appellate issue. And then, you know, another issue that came up is whether he had sufficient representation by his counsel. So that was another thing that he used in the appeals in order to get, you know, convictions overturned and get retrials and, you know, end up having, you know, several trials for the same murder, you know, as you mentioned, the Virginia Johnson case. And, you know, those are detailed more in the book itself.
Yeah, you talk about, too, that it's a conviction in the Michelle Sims case was one that they had pursued because of just more evidence that pointed to him. So they do go with a stronger case, obviously, and plea bargain some other ones that they might have some difficulty with. In the end, how many years did it take to get to the point where he was finally convicted and given the death penalty? And also, can you tell us a little bit about Lisa McVeigh's testimony, what it did for her? And you talk about postscript about Lisa McVeigh as well. So tell us a little bit about Lisa McVeigh's testimony and then how long it takes from the murder itself in the 84 to some resolution, I guess, finally, in this case.
Well, Lisa testified in 88, and she talked, you know, obviously she told the facts about getting abducted and things, and she was asked about why she hadn't tried to get away from him at various times, and she explained that she didn't want to piss him off, basically. You know, she didn't want to anger him or provoke him in any way, so she said she just wanted to cooperate and you know, hoping that that would give her the best chance of surviving. And she was asked, you know, about how he had acted at various times during the abduction. And, you know, she was asked if he seemed like a sick person, like a wacko. And she said yes. And that he had one time told her that he didn't know why he was doing it. Why he was doing the things he was doing to her. Maybe he was going nuts. And she admitted that as well. And, you know, the big reason why she wanted to testify too was to prevent him from being able to do this to anybody else. That was a big motivating factor for her. So she did testify, and, you know, following the various trials and appeals and retrials, he was ultimately finally the death sentence was upheld. In this is the early 90s, 92, the Florida Supreme Court upheld his death sentence in the Sims case. And in the Johnson case, that was ultimately upheld as well. I guess it would have been later on in the 90s. Trying to remember the exact date, but it was, you know, it was well after the murder. So it was years and years and a long, long process before he was finally affirmed for these killings. I guess it was over two decades before he was actually finally once and for all convicted of the murders. In 2014 and stretching all the way into 2016, you know, very recently.
Incredible.
These appeals and whether the trial court had acted properly in doing the things that it allowed in and evidence and things. So very long, drawn out legal process as these death penalty cases seem to involve, but this one, you know, more than a lot of others, certainly.
Yeah.
And you know, today Bobby Joe, you know, he hasn't had his execution date yet. He's still alive. He's still on death row in Florida.
You talk about that as well, but first let's talk about somebody like Lisa McVeigh. What did this whole experience motivate her to do in terms of her career path?
Well, she actually ended up becoming a deputy sheriff with the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. So the very agency that helped her and, you know, brought her abductor to justice, helped bring her abductor to justice, she ended up going to work for that agency. And a lot of her work has been with as an advocate for children, abused children. And she's taken it to use this really dark time from her life and this very negative experience and make positive by using it as a motivation for their victims and try to bring some light out of the darkness that she experienced.
Now we go to the Union Correctional Center in Rayford, Florida, and you talk about that Bobby Jo Long has got a lot of women pen pals. As you write in the book, tell us a little bit about what this Lotharia was doing in there. And before we talk about this very, very cryptic thing that was said by, again, one of the most infamous serial killers of all, while he and Long shared a cell, or at least shared an institution, tell us a little bit about what Bobby Jo Long is up to while behind bars.
Well, his appetite for these women certainly didn't seem to diminish because he's, you know, while he's been in there, he reached out to women different ways that he could, and including having things posted on the internet. And, you know, this man who was the classified ad rapist ended up posting his own classified ads essentially on the internet. And, you know, the things he posted are included in the book. But essentially he's, you know, soliciting women at all different ages for sexual interests that he has. And, you know, women have responded to this. And as you said, he's certainly had a lot of pen pals, a lot of women, female pen pals during his time there. So it's, you know, it seems really hard to imagine that women knowing what he's done would want to correspond and communicate with him about these kind of things, but they do.
Yeah.
And he's been, you know, definitely interested in having those kind of correspondent relationships, sexual relationships, so to speak. So those have been ongoing.
Now, you talk about before Ted Bundy's execution, January 89, he befriended Long while they were doing time together in Florida. What did Buddy Bundy tell an FBI agent about Long?
Yeah, so based on whatever conversations Bundy had with Long, it certainly made an impression on Bundy because he did mention to an agent that had assisted the task force there when they were investigating all these murders. Bundy mentioned to that FBI agent, he said, you know, it's a good thing you got him when you did. It's lucky you got him when you did, because otherwise his numbers would have surpassed mine. I mean, you know, obviously referring to his murder victims. And Bundy had quite a few himself. So for him to say something like that, certainly tends to give you a little bit of a pause.
Yeah, you know, the thing is when you can impress a guy like Ted Bundy, which, again, has impressed everybody in law enforcement and the world with his ghastly crimes, when Ted Bundy did reach out to law enforcement another time as well, at least, but it seems quite telling that he seems to be quite impressed with the potential of Bobby Jewel Long.
Yeah, and, you know, that's actually something that Gary Terry remarked about, too, that if they hadn't got Bobby Jewel when they did, if he hadn't made this error in letting Lisa McVeigh go, you know, if they hadn't got that lucky break and were able to catch him through that, you know, Gary Terry remarked that, you know, there's no telling what his victim count would have been. He would have just kept doing it because, you know, he certainly didn't feel any kind of remorse for what he had done. He never really expressed any true remorse for the killings and things. So he just would have kept doing it. You know, the number would have just kept going up. So very much in line with what Bundy had mentioned as well.
What was his behavior like at trial? Because, again, it seemed to be that there was a couple things going on or at different times. So tell us what behavior he exhibited during that trial.
At various times during the trial, behavior could change from just kind of being sullen and sitting there to having, you know, outbursts. And, you know, there were some occasions where he really exploded and made threats toward the prosecutor or whoever and really showed this kind of Jekyll and Hyde sort of personality going on there. So, you know, you could certainly see from that how he could deceive these women and, you know, fool them into thinking he's this nice, gentle kind of guy. And then of course he has this hidden monster inside that's unleashed later on, just as they saw at different times in his courtroom demeanor.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you talk about, I would think that Florida, where I thought Florida would have a quicker route to the death penalty, to execution. Why is it just because he's just finally got through with the 22 years, all of the appeals and motions that he could possibly have exercised as his rights? Is it now that there is some wait for a date, execution date for him? Or what is the climate in Florida right now regarding the death penalty?
Well, there, you know, fairly recently in Florida, there was a lot of challenges to the death penalty, and the statute and how the death penalty could be imposed. And it turned out that it was deemed to be improper or unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So the Florida legislature had to go back and rewrite the statutes for this and how a criminal defendant can be given the death penalty, how the death penalty can be imposed. So all that took a while to get sorted out. It finally has been, but it certainly affected how pending death penalty cases were being handled, whether they were moving forward or not, because you know there were a lot of challenges being made by all the people on death row, and that certainly disrupted things. But it's also taken traditionally. It's taken a while even before that. You know, a lot of these death row inmates spend many years on there. Some of them for decades. I don't remember off the top of my head what the average death row inmate stay is before they're actually executed in Florida, but it's pretty lengthy. I mean, it's a pretty lengthy process. So certainly Bobby Joe Long's been on there longer than a lot of them have. And the explanation for that is I'm really not sure why his case has been there for so long. I mean, he certainly had these appeals drag on for a long time, but he still hasn't had a death warrant signed yet for him. He doesn't have a execution date set. So, you know, the question of when that would occur, it's, you know, your guess is about as good as mine as far as that goes. It really just kind of depends on when the governor decides that it's time.
Do you think, in your opinion, from everything you've seen, because you cover murder trials in Florida, and so you've seen a lot of what goes on, do you think with all the natural opponents to the death penalty on one side, and then all the motions and appeals and extra care and caution that's afforded somebody that's been given the death penalty in Florida, do you think it's worth it in terms of this 22 years? We were talking about 1997, where they reversed the first degree murder. They've reversed a first degree murder conviction after Lisa McVeigh's testimony. You know, that was not sufficient for first degree, so that was an acquittal. You know, 22 years. Is maybe the attempt to have the death penalty just delay everything, is it really worth it, in your estimation, in terms of overall?
Man, that is such a loaded question, so to speak. You know, it's you know, there's good arguments on both sides, really, but it certainly seems like that the victims or the families of the victims shouldn't have to wait that long for justice. You know, you see examples where these families wait for so long that some of the family members die while these death row inmates are still alive, still living there, you know, waiting for their execution date. So it seems like there's something wrong with it in that respect. You know, certainly, you know, we have to protect the rights of individuals in this country, make sure they have a fair trial and that we're not executing innocent people. But on the other hand, it's such a huge use of resources over the years battling these things. And, you know, that's one of the arguments, of course, is it better just to give them all life sentences, and, you know, because it's ultimately cheaper that way. And really, I mean, it just boils down to people's opinions a lot, I think. You know, some of the victims' families think it's better for one of these defendants to rot in jail, so to speak, you know, live the rest of their years in the small cell. But others, want to see an eye for an eye kind of justice, you know, and see them actually pay the ultimate price and be put to death.
Yeah, and whether I believe in the death penalty, which I don't believe in it philosophically for other reasons, but I certainly do understand, I think I can understand how I would be asking for it, demanding it for it in these cases, having endured. Again, I think part of it, as you mentioned, is just takes so long. I think having to have retrials can only make the victims' families believe that there's something wrong with the judicial system. And not to say pro or con, just to say there's something wrong with the delay of justice.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us, in a sense, would like to see it kind of move forward a lot quicker and just be a judge, jury, executioner, bam, bam, bam kind of process. But you know, on the other hand, it is important to make sure that that things are being done properly and that police are putting these cases together properly, that evidence is being properly found and put forth, and that prosecutors are doing their jobs properly as well. So, you know, there are instances of abuse, you know, both in law enforcement and also in prosecutors prosecuting the crimes after the perpetrators are caught. So it is important to have that as well. But certainly in our gut, it certainly is a lot of the times there's this wish or desire that things could be expedited so much quicker than they are.
Yeah, certainly. Just for the survivors and the victims' families, and my heart goes out to those people, certainly, every time I read these stories. I want to thank you very much, JT Hunter, for coming on and talking about Deadly Deception, True Story of Tampa Serial Killer Bobby Joe Long. It's been a pleasure, as always. Thank you very much, JT. Hope to talk to you again real soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks again. It's as always, it's great to come on here and talk about these things with you. And you know, it's too bad the subject matter is as grim as it is, but the discussions are always very interesting and engaging. So thanks again for having me on.
Thank you very much. You have a great night. Good night.
Thank you.